all on the same block, so, I mean, you could go, too. So.
No, it's... Oh, we're all in the same town, too, but you're right next to him. If he's ever going to borrow anything, he'd come over to your place.
Well, he's busy now.
Nice. He's not busy. Now, look, he's going into... Go now, because if... I mean, he's going back in. If you were going to say hi, you should probably... There, he's going into the... You're going to lose him, because he's going to go in... Well, there, now you've blown it, haven't you?
No, I didn't blow it. He went into his house.
Chicken?
I'm not chicken because he went into his house.
Hello and welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about movies from Letterboxd, the social network for film lovers. Each episode, your hosts Gemma, that's me, and Slim are joined by a Letterboxd friend for a chat about their four favourite films according to their Letterboxd profile. We have links in the episode notes to the movies, lists, and people we talk about so you can follow along and add those movies to your watch lists. Today, we're moving into Mayfield Place and talking about The Neighbours with Jim Cummings, Letterboxd bestie, friend of filmmakers, and a filmmaker himself.
Jim's new film, The Beta Test, is on the festival circuit right now and coming to theaters in the fall. His other movies, Thunder Road and The Wolf of Snow Hollow, are available on demand, and you should watch them. Jim's Letterboxd handle is Jimmy C. That's Me, and his four favorites are Inside Out, Krisha, Children of Men, and The Burbs.
Oh my God.
And now, on with the show. Jim, we watched your four favorites this past week to prep for this exact moment, this conversation right now.
I'm honored.
And I have one question. Is Tom Hanks the greatest comedic actor of all time?
He's unbelievable. Especially in that film. In The Burbs, it is so funny to watch this guy struggle and have to put up with these insane neighbors and social dynamics. He feels like a camp counselor, and I don't think he gets cast in these funny roles anymore, but he's one of the best. And then it becomes incredibly profound. He goes from being this kind of like goofy, you know, beer drinking neighbor guy to then being this profound, thoughtful person in the ending monologue. And to see that woven, it's like, it is like watching Chaplin or something like that. He is so, so good in this film.
I am so excited to talk about The Burbs. And I'm going to suggest we save it till the end because otherwise we're in danger of this
entire
episode.
I'm so sorry. I jumped the gun.
We have
no,
to.
No. It's all Slim's fault. No,
that'd be great. So we just talk about The Burbs the next 40 minutes. It's like, also, he likes Krisha. Thank you so much for joining us.
The one thing I do want to bring up, too, about Tom Hanks, just because I think it's worth a refresher, that Tom Hanks has this, you know, history of an amazing comedic actor. My brother is older than I am. And I remember growing up seeing scenes from The Money Pit when I was like way too young to remember. You remember that? I think like the bathtub falls to the floor and he does that laugh scene.
It's amazing.
Nobody talks about that anymore.
It's amazing.
What's happening in our society? We need to wake people up, Jim.
Sheeple, wake up.
I just want to say that every time I'm thinking about my Letterboxd four favorites, and you know, we've already talked about mine on the first episode of the series, I think every now and then I think I should just make it big and the three best Indiana Jones films, because that's the truth, right? Wow. Those are the movies I will come back to again and again. But Big, Tom Hanks and Big is extraordinary. I know it's it's a mainstream film, but he just that just in the legacy and the canon of movies in which an adult is embodying a child or a child is embodying an adult, Tom Hanks he's the goat of that.
There's a good quote from Steve Martin when he was introducing Tom Hanks to the Oscars. He says, my next guest had the easiest job in Hollywood. If you only make hits, Tom Hanks. And it was like the best joke of like a guy who's only made great movies.
Well, let's go through your favorites on Letterboxd, and people can follow Jim's account in our episode notes. The first one on our list, it has it all. We're going to get emotional. It's Inside Out from Pixar. For those that have not seen it, you know, it follows the four characters, joy, fear, anger, disgust, but then also sadness. And they are living inside of the lead character's mind, where they help advise her through everyday life and tries to keep things positive. This is a movie, in my opinion, that kind of gets a little bit to the wayside in the lore of Pixar. But what was your first impression seeing Inside Out when it had first been released, Jim?
Oh, just crying my eyes out unabashedly. It was awful. It was humiliating to be... I saw it at a drive-in, and so everybody was kind of out of their cars, sitting in their cars. This was in, you know, 2015 when it came out. And there's the big scene with Bing Bong in it, and I had never seen something like that in an animated film, especially a comedy. And I cried my eyes out for like a week and a half. It was really brutal, and I had to see it a couple more times just to really feel it. And I've seen that movie so many times now. I feel like it's part of me, where at that point in watching Pixar's movies and watching movies in general, there was this dichotomy between something that was a really functioning drama that was very poignant and then a really funny comedy. And it was very difficult to fuse the two of them together. And I saw it when it came out in 2015, and I realized that that was something that you could do. You could make something that is both poignant and heartbreaking, and also very funny. And it doesn't make it worse, it makes it better. And I don't think that I would be where I am now had I not seen that film. I love every little bit of it. And not just for those characters that are inside of the mind, but also Riley, the girl whose head they're in. I think it really is one of the most important films ever made, because it is a lesson in how the brain and emotions work disguised as a kid's movie. And what a great lesson to teach children, that they are not in charge of their emotions, but they can be if they focus right. It's it is an unbelievable humanitarian effort that was put in by Pixar. And I love that movie so much.
I think especially over the last year and a half, when the emphasis on mental health has only been greater, you know, more important, and still not enough funding and still not enough resources. And everybody who is privileged enough to have access to a therapist has to talk to them just like this, just like we are. It's interesting to see how art can help us in these ways.
It's so crazy too, where I had never really had that intense or like potent of a cinema experience emotionally watching that film. Not just the music and Bing Bong saying "Sing Louder," and it's just so brutal. God damn it, Tamara. It's so, I can't think about it without crying. And it's so, it's about love and self-sacrifice and helping people. And then she says, after Bing Bong disappears, she goes, "Goodbye, Bing Bong." And it's the dumbest name in history. And then you're laughing again. And but no, it's a suicide in a Disney film. And it is shocking and beautiful and horrifying and so wonderful. And the music is unbelievable. And the characters are really great. And the world is so well thought out. And It functions in the same way that The Matrix does, where the prerequisite for enjoying the film is having a brain and knowing about deja vu and all of that stuff. It's like these great, you know, humanist ideas behind world building. And Pete Docter was just at the top of his game. And he has a whole team, apparently, from everything that I know about, that the best idea wins at Pixar. It doesn't matter where it comes from. And I think that's, you know, I've brought that into my work. And it's not necessarily about who's leading the ship. It's about helping everybody to make the best story. It is unparalleled to me in kids films. I often forget that it's a kids movie when people ask me what my favorite kids movies are. It's unbelievable.
Important question for the room. Have any amongst us had an imaginary friend?
I didn't. My sister did. And she would often talk to him until she was about 3 or 4. But then that was it. Did you?
No, I did not.
You did?
I did not. No.
Oh my God.
Nope.
You guys are missing out.
I had
Is
comic
just a
books.
Girl
so
thing?
Those were I had comic books, so those were my imaginary friends and my action figures. Those occupied my time.
Which action figure was your favorite?
Boy, you know what? Some of my earliest memories of action figures, my brother grew up also a big Chuck Norris fan. Do you remember the old Chuck Norris action figures?
Oh my God, yes.
And
That's
his
ridiculous.
Car, he had like this Corvette car that was legit AF. It was amazing. So yeah, needless to say, I was doing some ninja Chuck Norris stuff growing up, and I wanted his blue jeans and his cowboy boots, and it didn't happen, you know, eventually as I got older, but you know.
For those of you who can't see Slim, he's got a six-pack abs, and now he's wearing he's wearing cowboy boots and jeans, and he's kicking around, and it's a bit dangerous next to the microphones, but.
And I'm in a Corvette right now, that's how I'm recording.
He is badass. All right, continue.
I love it.
So I loved going back to watching Inside Out. I agree with you. I rated this 5 stars. The Bing Bong conversation with sadness is one of the greatest film moments in animation history, in my opinion. Multi-layered. And I think we have a bunch of stats. This is a 3.9 average on Letterboxd. It has 2,000 fans. So there's 2,000 other people that have this in their four favorites on Letterboxd.
Wow.
I feel like some of the lists it's on are perfectly suitable. You'll be happy to know, Jim, that you're not the only person who ugly cries when you watch Inside Out. There's a whole list of movies called Ugly Cry! Exclamation mark that Inside Out sits sort of right at the top of. Also on there, Stuart Little.
Stuart Little, sure.
A Dog's Purpose. I mean, why not?
Yeah. Life is Beautiful.
Girl Interrupted. Yeah, that was really, really gorgeous. Yeah. What else? Stepmom. Oh, don't even get me started. Susan Sarandon.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The Notebook, of course. Up. See, Up for me, the opening 15.
Yeah, they punch you in the stomach in the opening. It's like at least in Inside Out, they hold it to close to the end. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do have a funny story about Up. I know this is a non sequitur, but I saw it in New Orleans for the first time in 3D. And it was a bunch of adults, buddies of mine, just out of college, go see the movie. And it was this like quiet matinee screening. And at the end of the sequence that is so heartbreaking in the opening, there was a girl who was about two rows ahead of me. And she said at this volume, "Is she okay?" And everybody laughed in the theater. Like, everybody turned back to look at this poor girl. Yeah, it was horrifying.
Everyone wearing 3D glasses turning around to look at you was probably a sight in and of itself.
She was mortified.
Before we move on to Krisha, I think we need to sort of take a sidestep and talk a little bit about what you do with your characters in Thunder Road and Wolf of Snow Hollow. That sort of fits in, I guess, to what Inside Out is also doing, which we can see in, I guess, the real time within the films, your characters working out how all these feelings fit together and can coexist with each other, and how it's sort of okay to show vulnerability, specifically in Wolf of Snow Hollow, the hospital scene.
Yeah.
You know, that beautiful, with that beautiful camera movement and the refocus to the bed behind you, and oh my God, just like you're going to get me started.
It's so brutal too, to do that. I mean, that's like my favorite kind of cinema, is using the camera to help tell the story. And like, that is, I just find to be relatively absent in modern film. And to do it emotionally, I'm lifting all of that from Pixar, of like, you can just move the camera slightly and help tell the story of somebody died in the interim of this person being in the room the last time and then coming back. It's like, oh my God, like this poor guy. And then the same thing with Thunder Road, the ending shot of Thunder Road of me at the ballet, where it's like you see this guy go through hell for 80 minutes, I think, and then you see him be okay. He like helped his daughter. He was a good parent for once. I don't know. I think there is this ongoing thing with cinema audiences and cinephiles that they just want the characters to be okay, and that everything is all right. They just need to be confirmed that everything's going to be all right. And to do that for so long, for like 80 minutes of the movie, to watch the story of Job as a comedy and then have it pay off emotionally for the guy, it can be extremely cathartic, especially when it's a writer, actor, and director doing it, where it's like in a Jackie Chan film where everything ends up okay. It's like, oh, finally, Jackie's okay. You know, he got his ass kicked, but like, he's okay now. And it can be a better, or like a more potent conversation between filmmakers and the audience that I really only discovered through making my movies.
I read a quote from you because I was curious your thought process, where you were putting yourself in these shoes for these characters to go through these journeys. And you said, the stuff I like to write is about humiliating these characters and putting them through these places and paces. And I don't know if I want to put other people through that.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty fascinating answer, because it makes sense to me as the viewer. Your characters do go through the ringer. They make some really bad calls and they eventually do, you know, come out in the end, you know, for the better.
I think also that, I mean, that's what comedy is to me, of like watching someone just be constantly humiliated on accident for no fault of their own. And then that's also dramatic as well. Like Roberto Benigni has made a career out of these like kind of pathetic characters that the audience is like, oh, I just love this guy. Like, it'd just be okay. This guy can't catch a break. And so you can kind of wield the audience's emotions and attention throughout the narrative just by facial expressions, just by like stupid things that the guy does. And, you know, have him constantly fall on his face, sometimes actually falling on my face. But I love that. I get to pretend to be Jackie Chan and Charlie Chaplin for a month when we're making a movie. And it's the most fulfilling experience making myself look bad.
One of the other things, when we talked about Wolf of Snow Hollow last year, I didn't get to say this to you, but one of my other favorite things about it is, well, you cast Ricky Lindholm because she's, you know, I don't know if this is why you cast her, but for me it was wonderful because she's in, you know, the best ukulele guitar musical comedy duo of all time, Garfunkel and Oates, and I am a ukulele lover. I just love those two so much. We talked a little bit about the sort of gender dynamics that you explore in Wolf of Snow Hollow in terms of ambition and outcomes for their careers, but it's more about while you're putting your character through all of these humiliating sort of leaps of emotion, she's just the straight woman, right? She's so straight, but straight to the point where she gets to be withering in really wonderful moments, like when they're in the car and he's like,
"You think women have had to deal with shit like this since like the Middle Ages?"
She just looks
like he hadn't thought of it yet before. It's the first time he's thinking in real time, and then he has to change the subject. He's like, "That was a stupid thing to say." She is so amazing, and it's great at the end of the film. Like the whole movie is about this, you know, the father leaving the patriarchy of the sheriff's department, Robert Forster's character, and then you think, "I'm the heir apparent." And then, of course, she becomes the sheriff at the end because I've been a lunatic the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it's such a great moment to watch it with women in the crowd where that happens. And then everybody goes, yep, that makes sense. Just like, oh, thank God. Yeah. You know, it's great.
And finally, another thing I noticed about Wolf of Snow Hollow on this rewatch was it's a Christmas movie. So, you know, if you're listening and you've got a Christmas movie list, add it. But speaking of holidays, let's move now to your second of your four Letterboxd faves. Creature by Trey Edward Schultz.
An actual masterpiece that is shot in his mom's house and backyard in Texas. It is an unbelievable film. I guess I'll just talk about synopsis according to me. It's a film about a 65-year-old woman coming back to celebrate Thanksgiving with her family, having been gone for 10 years. And there are many reveals about her position in the family. She's apparently sober, and just the stress of being with the families and undergoing an American Thanksgiving with all the power and social dynamics in a household, she relapses. And it becomes this horror film, basically, dramatic horror film. And it's amazing. It is such a beautiful showcase of her as an actress, the rest of the family as actors. Trey Edward Schultz's mom plays his aunt in the film, his real life mom. So many of his family members are peppered throughout the movie, and they shot it for nothing in this house. And I saw it for the first time at its world premiere at South by Southwest. I ran down 6th Street in a suit to get to see this movie. And Trey was outside. He's like, "Got your ticket, got inside." Went inside and watched it. And it changed my life forever. It was the first time I had seen a Duplass style film made that showcased craftsmanship, that was very funny throughout, that was also very tragic and about an important subject. And within 5 months, I was doing the Thunder Road short film. It was the inciting incident for my life of this is what the future of American indie film renaissance can be. And it really is that for me. Like I cite that film being made and being released as the beginning of the American indie movement now.
Sheesh. That's quite a plug for anyone that hasn't seen this movie yet.
See,
you're on the edge of making your own films. I think you need to get off your rear end and check out this movie.
See it. It's unbelievable.
I knew I was in for a ride as soon as she was walking around the house with her luggage and she stepped in that mud. in her shoe. I was like, oh God.
And she goes to the wrong house in the opening. It's a one long take. Does. And she goes to the wrong house. Like, there's no dogs here. Is it in the right spot? And they go through the whole rigmarole of bringing her to another house. And then she has to go next door to the actual house. It's amazing.
Yeah. If you visualize me watching the movie, like the bead of sweat started to come down. Before she even got into the house for Thanksgiving, I was like, oh Lord.
It's great.
What an opening shot. What a setup. I mean, that shot, it goes from when she drives up in her pickup, right, all the way to the next door neighbor's house, all the way to the right house, in the door, down the hallway, and then all of the family members hug her.
Yep.
And then it's that whole...
And greet the baby. You get to meet, you find out the architecture of the house and the architecture of the family in one long take. And also, she doesn't even get out of the car before you know about her character, because her dress is hanging out of the side of the pickup truck. This woman's a bit of a wreck. It's so funny and so beautiful.
There's an amazing slow-mo shot in this film that, I don't know, we should talk about.
The entire sequence with Nina Simone, he just had, because of all of the stakes building throughout this, and like the how important tonight is for this family and for Krisha particularly, when something goes awry, even if it's something small in retrospect in real life, it makes it feel like you're watching a planet explode or something. It's so tense in watching this sequence. And it's this beautiful slow-mo sequence with a Nina Simone song underneath it, and it feels like a music video. It goes into anamorphic widescreen with real anamorphic lenses.
Yeah. For once in the movie, those douchebag sons and cousins aren't fighting each other or arm wrestling. Everyone's quite peaceful and chill. Doyle's not talking about eating leather and shitting saddles. It's like... We're finally at a beautiful moment, and then, oh my God.
And then it gets ruined, of course, but it's the climax of the movie, and it's such a small climax, but it's amazing. I actually do have some good behind-the-scenes discussion of that, because I'm an associate producer of Krisha, after having seen it at South By and then bringing it to Skywalker Sound to have it have its final mix.
How did that work? So you got obsessed with this movie.
I got obsessed with the movie.
Kicked off your career.
And then I said, how can I help this movie to Trey and the team? And he was like, well, we still need to like do a final mix. And I was like, I know the people at Skywalker. Maybe they'll give us a friend rate. And they did. And so they had just gotten into Cannes, and I said, let's go up and do it. And so I drove up from Los Angeles to San Francisco and flew the two boys in, Brian McComber, the composer, and Trey. And we stayed in an Airbnb outside of Skywalker Sound and mixed the movie for 3 or 4 days with Michael Semanek. So that whole time I got to like hear about all of Trey's directing abilities. And I feel like it was a bit of a boot camp for me to learn what it's like to be a bit of a director. And that arm wrestling sequence is a fight scene between Chase Joliet and Brian Casterly, and they play these kind of warring brothers. And before shooting it, Trey went up to Brian and said, look, I really need you to win this arm wrestling championship, because if you doesn't, it's going to ruin your character arc and it's going to be a problem for the rest of the movie. I need you to win this thing. And he goes, okay. And he goes up to Chase and he goes, look, I really need you to win this arm wrestling competition. And so when you're watching, it's like, wow, they are really fighting. And it's ridiculous. Trey is such a champ.
There's a theme that is similar in this movie of alcoholism, obviously, in Wolf of Snow Hollow. Yep. And some folks might not seek those kinds of movies out. So how do you, as a viewer, emotionally prepare yourself for movies that are just so heavy like this?
Yeah, it's a tough thing. It took me a long time to watch Come and See, even though it was out on the Criterion Channel. And I was like, I don't know if I want to watch something that everybody says is traumatizing. I don't know. With Krisha, it's so well woven into the filmmaking that it feels like you're in good hands of a filmmaker. And so because you're being chaperoned on this roller coaster, the important, cultural elements of drug abuse and alcoholism seem to be plot points, and then it kind of washes over you. You don't think that you're being preached to until you've had a week to think about it and cry, like I did.
Right. And then you find a bing bong scene, the bing bong moment of this movie.
But I don't know. That's a good question. It was a difficult thing with Thunder Road. I wanted to make something about the opioid epidemic, because Springsteen's music is all about leaving this dead end town. And I was like, well, what is a dead end town nowadays? And like, what is America going through right now? And it's, you know, most people don't think that that's what the movie is about. It becomes about that a bit. But if you can make jokes and distract people throughout, it's a bit of sleight of hand. You get to say something important while doing goofy slapstick.
I mean, there's a literal slap in Thunder Road that'll knock your socks off.
There is.
Without spoiling anything.
That is controversial.
A big regret.
I know you read Letterboxd reviews, Jim.
I do.
Have you thought about that scene since, in terms of seeing reactions to it, and wondered if you would change anything?
I don't think that I... So at the end of Thunder Road, my character does a lot of stuff, but at the end of Thunder Road, he slaps a corpse. And it is the corpse of his ex-wife recently. It is pretty graphic. And most people, when they see it, gasp. And then a few messed up people laugh. But I wanted to show something that was really voyeuristic, that you're in a room with a guy who's alone, who's a cop. I kept it in because I thought, you know, I've seen all these A24 movies and they're relatively unsanitized, and Dario Argento is doing all kinds of crazy stuff like that. And like, it is interesting though, to put it into a drama and a comedy, it becomes more shocking. It's like the bed of nails theory. If you go into a horror movie, you're far more okay with someone getting their head cut off with a chainsaw. But if it's a comedy and someone slaps a corpse, it can be far more shocking. It's one nail rather than a bed of nails, harder to stand on. But no, it is interesting. There are like reviewers on Letterboxd, friends like Demi Adejiyibe, who when he first saw it said, "I think it's a perfect movie except for this one thing that happens in the end." And that's fine. I mean, that's, you know, I made the movie in 2017 and it's okay. And yeah, I think I can't change it now. So it's there, unfortunately.
Or fortunately, depending on how people are rating it. Speaking of ratings, we've talked about this before, about the fact that you only rate things 5 stars on Letterboxxd. Yeah. And if they're not a 5-starer for you, then we pretty much know about it because you don't rate it. But that's not to say it's not a 4-star. But what you also do is you go through other people's Letterboxxd reviews of your movies and thank them or give other great feedback. And I just think, wow, that's quite time and labor intensive, but also really lovely.
It's great. It's great. It's part and parcel for me. One of them is, you know, the endorphin rush of people and finally seeing the reaction of people watching the films. You know, I haven't been able to greet people in a lobby having screened a movie recently. It's nice to kind of have an interaction. I think the first rule of filmmaking is you know your audience. This is like the perfect way to know the audience and how the films are actually working inside the minds of the viewers. And then also, there are people on Letterboxd that will review Thunder Road and say, this movie couldn't have come at a better time for me. I was so lost and I just lost someone. And I always message those people, or I'll find them on Twitter and do the same thing and say, hey, I'm here if you ever need to talk. And that kind of becomes your job. If you make a really deeply emotional movie, you become this lightning rod for people who are going through hell in the same way that Springsteen was. It's an honor and it's not taxing on me. It's nice to be able to help people.
And then there are the people who watch Thunder Road and write, Jim Cummings plays a very hot DILF.
That is true. I think I responded to that one. I think I might have said, oh, Christ.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. It takes all kinds on Letterboxd.
I mean, speaking of hot DILFs, shall we talk about Clive Owen?
Oh, my God. Perfect transition. Theo Farron, played by Clive Owen in Children of Men, one of my favorite movies of all time. He is so wonderful and so, you can't take your eyes off him. And the movie's basically following him the whole time. But that performance, it was like the first time I really took my hat off to that guy. I think the first film I saw of him was Croupier back in the day. They had it on HBO when I was a kid. And so I had known of him, but then seeing that film, I walked out of the movie theater and bought a ticket and walked right back in. It was it was unbelievable. 2007. And I had grown up in high school and in film school watching Tarkovsky's movies and seeing, you know, long takes. And Itamar Tambien has like so many single take coverage of scenes. And so I knew that could be, you know, something that I'd like to do. And then seeing it done so well in Children of Men, it felt like this beautiful fusion of what Spielberg was doing And then what Tarkovsky was doing. And I was like, oh, you can do them both at the same time. This is so cool for me. And I loved it. Yeah, that movie is one of the most emotional films that I can think of, only in retrospect. It's an action film when you're watching it. It's just disguised as an action film. Mm-hmm. But then you realize that he is trying to save this child as a love letter to his child who died in a few years prior. And when you're watching it, I watched it with my mom and later in life. And the moment when he runs into the building and everybody's shooting at each other, it's a war zone. And it's like, this guy's insane. What's he doing? He should just like run away. And mom was like, no, that's what you do as a parent. Like, that's what you're supposed to do. And it's so beautiful. Yeah. It's such an incredibly poignant, incredibly executed film. And it's an experience.
Do we have a second round of tears?
Come on. Every time she calls
me out. You are earning your money today. You are earning your money.
Well, you asked me my favorite movies. This is why this is part of me. This is why I got into this stuff. I should have agreed to this podcast. Sorry, continue.
I fully support men being in touch with their emotions and expressing their emotions to the fullest. I'm 100% on board. I
live on air. Yeah, great.
This absolutely. Especially if it's on a podcast, even better. Especially one that I'm on. 2006 this came out. I rewatched this this past week. 5 stars. Easy.
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 The first few minutes of this movie are so bonkers. This movie is so timeless. I forgot about a ton of this movie. You know, Clive Owen, miraculously, there's a pregnant woman. He's a former activist. He's protecting her. There are so many good long take shots. I mean, the chase scene where the biker pulls up to their car with Julianne Moore.
It's unbelievable.
Are you kidding me with that scene? You can't top this.
And you can't believe you're watching it either. It's like it's there's so many magic tricks that go into that. If you Google, for anybody listening, what the behind the scenes is on that film, it's insane. They had to build the car, and then they have Chibo, the cinematographer, on the roof of the car and lighting setup, and then they comp in a fake roof and then move the camera around on the inside. And all of the actors had to put their seats back so that the camera could move over them for certain moments. It's like a ballet circus to get that experience of being in the car. And it shows itself. It's like one of the best magic tricks in cinema history. And they had no business. That movie has no business being that good, and it's unbelievable.
I want to talk about quiet moments in this film, because we talk a lot about these big shots, these big ones, and the incredible shootout in the building at the end, and then the soldiers stopping. For me, it's moments like when Clive Owen and Michael Caine are just sitting on the couches at Michael Caine's house, chatting, and there's the ginger cat, and there's the dog, and there's, you know, beautifully behaved, really fluffy pets, and they're just kind of petting them and chatting about old times. And
it feels like you're getting stoned with Michael Caine in his living room.
Right?
It's great.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But also, you know, we've only got a couple of hours with these people.
Yeah.
And any scene like that takes, I don't know, maybe it's 3 minutes, but it feels like you've been a week in that house. And that in those 3 minutes, you've built up the history. There's so many ways in which you can do exposition in a movie that can take you out of the moment and change the tone. And in this film, we learn that Michael Caine was a great political cartoonist. We learn that his wife was one of the world's best, you know, war photographers. We learn it through living with these characters rather than being told. And my favorite such scene is when Michael Caine's character is telling Key and Miriam what happened to Theo and Julian's son.
Yeah.
And he's in the foreground. He's just in the foreground by the kitchen, listening, pouring himself a wine, listening. And we're learning in the background what happened to that son. You know, partly it's also interesting watching it this week because they talk about, the film came out 2006. They talk about losing him in the influenza epidemic of 2008. And I'm like,
yeah.
Spooky.
Yeah, I mean, that's subtlety. Like, to focus the camera and the story entirely on him pouring himself something, and then you're hearing this guy who's being talked about listen to one of his best friends tell the story that's tragic in the background, and you're just seeing them out of focus being told this stuff. It's like, you're with this guy, and it immediately connects you to him. Another wonderful thing that they do, two things. all the animals love Theo. They love Clive Owen. They're always like climbing on his legs. He's just like, that's just such a wonderful thing for the filmmakers to be like, this is a likable guy. You know, the animals love him. And then the other one is they're constantly showing what's going on his feet, where like he'll step outside in socks and then it's just wet. And then he's just like, oh, this poor guy. And then he has to go through this sequence of just like wet socks. And then he's got to put flip flops on during the big battle sequence. Yeah. Like now he's going through these like rubble and flip flops. Like this poor guy. And then like when they cut to those small moments of like a breather in between these big action scenes, it's like him with his feet in hot water. And it's like, we're okay now. We're safe. It's great. It's great.
Jim, I thought you were going to say your favorite scene with Michael Caine was when he said that iconic line, pull my finger.
It's actually right before that. And it's when Michael Caine comes out and he's telling them to get in the car, and his whole performance of his character is, oh, this is fine. I dealt with this in the war. Like, this is nothing, kid. Yeah. And he waves goodbye like this to the little baby, to the girl she's leaving. And then they take off, and then it cuts to them in the rooftop, and the guy comes out of the house, the bad guy comes out of the house and goes, there's a dead woman and a dog inside. And so he knew, he went in to do this thing knowing that he was going to get killed, and he's just faking it for his friends to make sure they got away safe. Unbelievable.
Also, I'm pretty sure he tells him, or when they encounter him in front of the house, when he doesn't pull his finger, he's like, fuck you.
Yeah, shoots him in the hand. That's so good.
That is so good.
It's great.
The other great exchange when we first meet Michael Caine in the car with Clive Owen, obviously, is when they're talking about baby Diego and what a wanker he was. Yeah. He was a wanker.
Baby Diego, come on. That guy was a wanker.
He was the youngest wanker on earth. Pull my finger, quick.
Oh, just man.
Which is so great. I feel like that's how most people talk about stuff that's in the news. It's like, you're supposed to love this guy, have the reverence for this kid. He didn't have any choice. I mean, he was just the youngest kid. It's just great. It's so great.
Should we get to the main course of the evening? The Burbs, starring Tom Hanks. 3.5 average. This is your final favorite movie in your top four on Letterboxd. I have heard of this movie growing up, and I grew up, I put in my Letterboxd review, I grew up with like Scrooged. I watch Scrooged every year, and I feel like I don't love it as much every year I watch it. I pick it apart. But The Burbs is a movie I was like comparing to Scrooge. Man, I wish I could watch this every year. It's not on Hulu. It's not on Netflix. And I was a man possessed when I watched this movie for the first time last week. 5-star. Easy 5-star again.
Easy.
Easy. But Jim, how does this fall into your life? Where did you first see this movie and what's its impact on you?
So the trick is you got to get the Blu-ray from England and you got to order it on eBay and it'll come in and that's how you get to watch it. And you have to convert a Blu-ray player in your house to be another region.
Easy enough.
So this movie came into my life when I was a child. We had it on VHS. And my dad, for a minute, had a van that had a TV mounted in the centerpiece of the van. So, like, right behind his head. And it had a VCR in it. So we would watch Indiana Jones and The Burbs all the time. And it's funny, is like The Burbs, because we had it, I assumed everybody had this movie and that it was like, you know, universally loved. But really, it flopped kind of when it came out. It did not do as well as they thought that it would, despite the quality of its filmmaking. But I used to watch it all the time. And I always found it so funny because the character of Art is just so ridiculous. He is this like Boomhauer kind of like Mike Judge style character where everything that you're laughing at about this character is how his brain works. And I think that's how, that's what got me into comedy, I think, was watching this film and understanding the ensemble social dynamics of the cul-de-sac and how this nutcase Art was a part of it. And there's so many wonderful zingers from this guy. I mean, obviously, his last line in the film where Rumsfeld says, hey,
your wife's home.
And your house is on fire.
And he turns around and goes, my wife is home. But it just gets you into the guy's head. And like, I didn't know that you could do that with comedy until I saw this film. That like, there is such thing as character comedy where any other character in the film saying that dialogue wouldn't work. It has to be this guy. It's so specific. And so that movie really educated me of what exciting filmmaking and comedy are fused together. And I still think it's probably the best.
When I watched Wolf of Snow Hollow, after watching The Burbs, I was like, man, I totally could see Tom Hanks in your role. Like, I was like, you know, almost like swapping them, and it would work perfectly. But with The Burbs, Joe Dante directed from the director of Gremlins, follows Tom Hanks's character and his buddy on this cul-de-sac, thinking there's something nefarious happening in one house. You know, this is another timeless movie. You could think of you talking with your neighbors about another neighbor. And you're not really sure during the majority of the film if there is a horror element to this plot, you know, until you get to the very end. I agree with you. This is a movie that I want to like throw DVDs at people.
Yep.
You need to watch this movie. We need Paramount to wake up a little bit and put this on some kind of app.
It's great because it is, well, it's a Universal film.
Oh.
I only know that because of the opening, because it moves. It has that dope shot of moving around the Universal logo and coming in.
Yes, it's on one of the lists it's on Letterboxd is a great list called Subverting the Studio Logo.
Oh, no way.
It's, yep. Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
That's, It is so cool. And then Zodiac, another one where they have the old Paramount logo. It's like the 1960s or 70s one to get you in the mood. I think really like that kind of filmmaking is just so absent these days, where like it is something that feels like it is a Twilight Zone episode done as a comedy that is like a timeless idea about, you know, who are these strange people that live next door? It smells like they're roasting a cat in their basement. Like somebody's got to say something. And it's all done in this like patina of a summer fun movie. And then the horror stuff slips in. And it's really interesting that it's like they're doing both at the same time so well. And then I'm not spoiling anything, but at the end of the film, at the climax of the film, there is a wonderful monologue, one of the best by Tom Hanks. It's kind of all one shot where he comes to the conclusion that the Klopeks are not bad guys. They're not evil ghouls. They are normal people, and that they're the bad guys. They're the ones who have been jumping fences and burning the neighbors' houses down. Yeah. It's like, we're the nutcases. So like, we're the people that live in the suburbs who have lost their minds. And it's so poignant and so wonderful. And then the movie becomes something different after that. But it's really, really poignant. It leaves the audience thinking, oh, that's the point of this movie. And it's really good.
One of the many, many things that made me giggle, and I'd never seen this before, you know, obviously some reason it flopped overseas. So I don't know if it made it into theaters in New Zealand, you know, and I'm certain I would have gone because this is exactly the kind of jam me and my brothers were into through the 80s, early 90s. So it was a first time watch for me this week. And it's a long time, like, you know, there are movies that make me laugh. Wolf of Snow Hollow makes me laugh, but it's a long time since a movie just made me giggle. Just outright. Like, there's a difference between a giggle and a laugh, right? And there were just moments where I'm like, doors slamming open. So many doors hit so many people in this movie. Like the plate
and
of
the brownies.
Is it Corey? Yeah, the brownies. Corey Feldman holding the plate of brownies. I'm like, wow, what a great piece of art department that plate was, because that smashed up so beautifully.
It's so wonderful. I'm realizing how much I steal from this movie, but the poignance of Art walking through the house and he has this lighter. He's like, lit a cigar, and he has this lighter that they're in their neighbor's house who's disappeared, and he takes the lighter and he goes, this is all going to end up in like a junk pile a couple weeks from now. Like, he's assuming the guy's dead, and he pockets the lighter and he keeps walking, trying to be cool. And then Tom Hanks goes, are you going to take that lighter out of your pocket? Are you not going to steal that from our neighbor's house? And it's like the movie commenting on itself that you could totally get away with in a normal movie. It's so incredible.
Yeah. One of the lists that this film is on Letterboxd is called Films That Anticipated the Notion of Being Too Online. And it's a little bit like these guys are kind of stuck in a Facebook group full of disinformation or something.
Oh, and they're just adding to do that. Right? To make a movie about a Facebook group in a neighborhood and then how toxic that can get. Yes. One of my favorite, also they act like children throughout. They're like boys throughout, and they're supposed to be grown men. One of my favorite moments is when he's in the doghouse with Carol, the Carrie Fisher, and then he's out on the porch and then he sees his friends walking up the driveway and he goes, no, don't come up here. And then she comes up and goes, what are you guys doing here? He goes, we're wondering if Ray can come out and play. And she goes, he's not able to come out until he resembles the man I married. And Ray, and then Art goes,
Carol, we don't have that kind of time.
Come on. I think that I'm just genius. Yes, and then meanwhile, you've got Corey Feldman, who's he's a little bit like Statler and Waldorf, right? Yeah. He's the guy on the veranda, kind of commenting on the whole thing. And then there's this beautiful moment when his girlfriend says, he's like, he's set up on the veranda to watch what's going down tonight because they're going into the neighbor's house. And she's like, can we just go and watch a movie? He's like, a movie? That's not real. It's the same as television. This is real. This is my neighborhood.
Yeah. He's so good in that movie. He becomes this like chaperone for the audience where it's like the audience is laughing at these characters. And then when he's describing him, it's like, this is Ray. He's the guy who really knows what's going on. And then this is Art. He's a dumb idiot. And like they smoke cigars together. They think their wives don't know about it. It's like really funny contextualizing, kind of leading the audience's excitement through the movie. It's brilliant. I got to talk to Joe Dante a few weeks ago.
Shut up. And,
yeah. So, yeah, I told you this on the pre-show, but I live about four blocks from the cul-de-sac of the Burbs. I live right next to Universal Studios now, which is really cool. I get to like walk up the road and just be like, oh, that's where they shot it. It's unbelievable. And then when I'm watching a movie now, I'm like, that's a hill. I know that hill in the background. And he said that they shot the whole film chronologically. So they shot it scene one, scene two, scene three, for the most part, because of people's schedules and because they had to blow up the house at the end. And he said it was really ridiculous because so often with these comic actors, they were getting better improv than what they were getting in the script. So much of it was improv because it was working on the day. And I was like, how do you do that? Like, all of my films are so forensic. They have to be. And he's like, Universal is paying for it. Like, it's a huge buzz, a Tom Hanks movie.
Speaking of making movies, the beta test.
Yeah.
It's on the circuit now. I just want to know, why all the secrecy? Why can't we have a screener? What's the story?
Yeah.
Why is it so special?
Yeah. So for a long time, we had anonymous sources named in the credits. Sorry. The film is about the WGA packaging fight with the agency world. So it is a real-time thing when we were making it and finishing the film. So we didn't want anybody to see it. We have testimony and documents that went into the film that make up some of the dialogue and some of the background. And we had 11 assistants, agents, ex-agents, and ex-assistants give us testimony of what it's like to work in an agency during this fight. And it's brutal. I'm laughing about it now, but it is really a toxic and awful workplace, specifically for women. And it's crazy. So we didn't want anybody to see it. And instead, we had screenings in my backyard for anybody that wanted to come and see it. And now it's finally going to come out into the world in the first week of November. And then it'll be in theaters in October in the UK, maybe Australia, and in France.
So we don't have to feel left out for too much longer.
No, I think very soon.
We have a section on this show where we go through your movies on Letterboxd you rate, but rated higher than the average, according to Letterboxd. So we pulled titles. You know, maybe we can get a few quick takes. But Leonardo DiCaprio's film appeared on this list that you gave 5 stars.
The Beach, I assume.
Yeah, The Beach.
The Beach is a wonderful movie that makes me feel nostalgic for a life I never had. The music is fantastic. It's about Thailand in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it's just entire mise-en-scene is so wonderful and fun and sexy. And then the Alex Garland story of it being this wonderful, glorified, youthful, sexy adventure and pot smoking then becomes extremely real and humanistic and about how man is the most dangerous animal, and it's very poignant. So that's why I really love that film.
Wow, there's another one on there. This turns off again. Like, this is like, we're into episode 6 now, and this is the second time that Tintin has made an appearance as a 5-banger for one of our guests.
It is so unreal. And it's weird that like it hasn't really been talked about as one of the adventure classics that many of his other films or their other films have been. But it's so fun to watch and it's so exciting and adventurous. And it's so well paced. It's incredible to look at. Like, I don't know how, it must have been the most expensive movie of all time, but the performances are fantastic and you're constantly with the characters, a bunch of long takes, really an exciting, fun thrill ride for the whole family. And it's Tintin. It's like my favorite comics growing up. So I'm double spoiled. I think that is such a masterpiece of filmmaking.
Last time we spoke, you had just come from an audition for one of the greatest directors in the world.
I did.
I don't know if you got a role in that movie.
I did not. But if you want to rub it in, I'm here all day.
It's vintage Gemma.
But I guess, you know, when are we going to see Jim Cummings in something not written and directed by Jim Cummings?
So the director she's talking about is Martin Scorsese, who saw Wolf of Snow Hollow, I think on iTunes when it came out, because I assume he saw it on iTunes and said, "The Wolf of something else? What? They've stolen my title." Clicked it and watched it and really enjoyed it. And he brought in, I think, 3 or 4 actors from the cast from that film to audition for the new movie. And I think at least one of them has a part in the film, but it's not me. But it was fine. I got to meet his casting director, Ellen Lewis, who cast everything. She's unbelievable and treated me like a real actor, which is insane. But I never get asked, really. Nobody asks me to act in movies. I'll be in a big one that's coming out later this year. No spoilers.
Bond.
But, oh, my God. Yeah. I'm in it for a second. I get shot and fall down a flight of stairs. No.
Yeah.
No, I'm in a one that's coming out in the fall that's bigger that I didn't direct that I'm stoked.
Is it a secret?
It is a secret.
Is it a secret?
I don't think it's a secret. I just haven't told anybody yet.
I think that's technically a secret.
I'm in Halloween Kills.
Is that real? Oh, my God.
Are you
really?
Serious?
Yeah. Man, yeah. You must have been sitting on that one for a while, right?
No, it was about 2 years ago. I was in Wilmington in October of 2019.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Holy shit, Jim.
Yeah. It was really cool.
Halloween just got
a real hero of mine, David Gordon Green. I saw all the real girls when that movie came out, and that was another one for me that you can be a Southern boy and make movies.
Probably just retire after that. There's no getting better than that. Yeah. Entering into the Halloween
in the Michael
lore.
Universe. Jeez. Yeah. Yeah. I would love to act in more movies. I just, the only time I ever get cast and stuff is when I say I want to make a movie and then I just direct myself.
Martin probably watched Inside Out and didn't like it.
He had some criticism about my top 4 Letterboxd movies. So
he's listening to this and he just slammed his fist on the table. He's like, I can't stand this top 4.
The Burbs? not going to happen. Got this kid off my side.
Is there anything else you want to say to the people of Letterboxd before you go?
Keep sharing movies with me. I really have raised the ceiling of my happiness and fulfillment over the last year, which is people saying, hey, you should check out this one. This one's really good. And I wouldn't have seen Corpus Christi had it not been for Letterboxd and people saying this is worthwhile. Yeah, keep sharing stuff with me. It means the world.
Thanks so much for listening to The Letterboxd Show, and thanks to our guest this episode, Jim Cummings, for sharing his love of his favourite movies. The Beta Test, the next one from him, is coming to US cinemas digital and on demand via IFC later this fall if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, or later this spring for me, and it's opening earlier in some other lucky territories.
You can follow Gemma, Slim, that's me, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. Thanks to Composing Dynamo's Moniker for the theme music Vampiros Dansotech. And if you're enjoying the show and have guest ideas, be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Quick shout out to Natalia for her review and guest recommendation.
And thanks very much to Linda Moulton, our booker. And that's the show. I'm going to go change into my vacation togs.
I'm sorry they took your rocket. They took something that you loved. It's gone. Forever.
Sadness. Don't make him feel worse.
Sorry.
It's all I had left of Riley.
I bet you and Riley had great adventures.
Oh, they were wonderful. Once we flew back in time, we had breakfast twice that day.
Sadness!
It sounds amazing. I bet Riley liked it.
Oh, she did. We were best friends.
Yeah, it's sad.
I'm okay now. Come on, the train station is this way.
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.